It is 3 hours Universal Time. Good morning, Africa. Today is Wednesday, August 31st. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Butte in Washington. First, the news headlines. Libya's National Transitional Council sets a deadline for loyalist Gaddafi forces to surrender. The United Nations reassesses security threats in Nigeria after the Abuja bombing. And Kenya's government loses its appeal to halt ICC trials. Now the news in detail. Libya's provisional authorities have announced a four-day deadline for forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi in his hometown of Sirte to surrender. National Transitional Council leader Mustafa Abdel Jalil said his forces will initiate military action in Sirte if pro-Gaddafi troops do not complete negotiations and surrender by Saturday, one day after the end of the Muslim holiday. Anti-Gaddafi forces say they are bracing for a final battle to gain control of Libya's last pro-Gaddafi holdouts. The four-day ceasefire relates primarily to Sirte, but also covers loyalist strongholds in Bani, Wali, and the southern city of Sabha. On Monday, Algeria allowed some of Mr. Gaddafi's family members, including his wife Safiya, daughter Aisha, and two of his sons, Mohammed and Hannibal, to enter the country from Libya. In Washington, U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland said the Gaddafi family was under a UN-mandated travel ban.
We care in terms of the fact that under UN Security Council Resolution 1970, the Gaddafi family was subject to a travel ban. So they have now traveled. The government of Algeria has sent a letter to the UN. We are reviewing that letter now in New York, but clearly there has to be an international community decision and response with regard to the travel ban restrictions that 1970 imposed.
Zimbabwe has given Libya's ambassador to Harare 72 hours to leave the country. Zimbabwe's foreign ministry minister said Tuesday the decision was made after the Libyan embassy declared its allegiance to Libya's Transitional National Council. Last week, during a protest, Ambassador Tahel El Mangrahi and embassy staff members burned the flag used by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. They then raised the flag being used by the anti-Gaddafi TNC. A human rights group wants some major banks to reevaluate their ties to banks in Zimbabwe, saying the ties indirectly support the trade in so-called blood diamonds. Partnership Africa Canada says the banks, including Britain's Barclays and South Africa's Standard Bank, are not involved in the Zimbabwe diamond trade. But the organization says the banks partner with Zimbabwean banks that have ties to the Marenge diamond fields. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the United Nations will review security threats to its buildings around the world in the wake of last week's bombing of the UN headquarters in Nigeria. Mr. Ban told the UN Security Council Tuesday that the international organization will be undertaking a full review of the bombing itself, as well as what he called a global threat review. He said that clearly the United Nations and its workers are being targeted more and more often by terrorists. Sudan has submitted a complaint about South Sudan to the UN Security Council, accusing the South of sparking unrest in a border state. A spokesman for Sudan's foreign ministry said Tuesday that the complaint accuses South Sudan of supporting rebels in Sudan's southern Kordofan state. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said Tuesday they have evidence of an indiscriminate bombing campaign by Sudanese forces. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland said Tuesday in Washington that the U.S. was deeply concerned by reports of aerial bombings of civilian areas.
The United States is deeply concerned about reports of continued Sudanese Air Force bombings of civilian areas in southern Kordofan, despite President Bashir's announcement of a unilateral two-week ceasefire last Tuesday. The United States calls upon the government of Sudan to adhere to its commitments and encourages the Sudan People's Liberation Movement to declare a two-week ceasefire in southern Kordofan.
The International Criminal Court is going forward with cases against six prominent Kenyans linked to deadly post-election violence in the country. That is the news from the Voice of America. Morning Africa. Today is Wednesday, August 31st. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations sees a global consensus to take the lead in the initial post-Gaddafi phase in Libya.
My aim is to get UN personnel on the ground absolutely as quickly as possible under a robust Security Council mandate.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The African Union rejects accusations that it failed to end the Libyan conflict. Tomorrow marks 42 years since Muammar Gaddafi seized power in Libya, but his whereabouts remains unknown as the anniversary approaches. And two prominent Ethiopian politicians are detained.
Bassana Garba was arrested in his alleged connection in relation with his involvement with a recently proscribed terrorist organization, OLF.
The former TRC chairman calls for a suspension of Liberia's October elections as referendum results are set to be announced today, Wednesday. And a new report says international banks are connected to Zimbabwe's illegal diamond sale. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Tuesday that there is broad international consensus that the United Nations should lead the post-Gaddafi phase in Libya. Mr. Ban told the Security Council that the National Transitional Council, or the NTC, appears to be largely in control of the capital Tripoli and that he believes a quick conclusion to the conflict is in sight. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
Mr. Ban told the 15-member council that he has spoken several times during the past week with the chairman of the NTC, Mustafa Abdeljalil. He said they discussed the UN's role in Libya during the coming months in areas such as election assistance, justice, security enforcement, and humanitarian assistance. The Secretary General said the Libyan people are looking to the international community for help and that the National Transitional Council will outline its specific needs in the coming days. Mr. Ban noted that the heads of regional organizations, including the European Union, the African Union, and the Arab League, also support the United Nations leading post-conflict efforts.
My aim is to get UN personnel on the ground absolutely as quickly as possible under a robust Security Council mandate.
Mr. Ban's special advisor on post-conflict planning, Ian Martin, told reporters after the council's meeting that UN assistance would not be in the form of peacekeepers deployed to the country, but that the NTC might consider UN assistance in training Libya's future police force.
And in our discussions with the NTC, it's very clear that the Libyans want to avoid any military deployment by the UN or others. They are very seriously interested in assistance with policing to get the public security situation under control and gradually develop a democratically accountable public security force.
Also Tuesday, the UN Security Council Sanctions Committee on Libya approved the release of a little more than $1 billion in frozen Libyan assets from British banks. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague said the money would go to help address urgent humanitarian needs, pay the salaries of key public sector employees, and free up cash in the Libyan economy. Those funds are in addition to the $1.5 billion held in U.S. banks that the committee unfroze last Thursday. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The African Union, or the AU, is rejecting criticisms that it failed to resolve Libya's civil war. Critics say the AU's efforts were impeded by divisions among heads of state and their personal relationships with the deposed Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. AU spokesman El Ghassim Wan tells reporter Peter Clotty the continental body will continue to promote reconciliation and help build institutions to serve as foundation for democracy and the rule of law in Libya.
Well, the Peace and Security Council of the African Union met on the 26th to deliberate on the matter. As you are aware, we have been actively involved in the efforts of finding a solution to the conflict, notably through the ad hoc committee on Libya. Of course, the events on the ground have evolved very, very quickly. But we still believe that some key components of the African Union roadmap are relevant, especially those pertaining to transition and the promotion of democracy in Libya. The key element of the decision that was taken is to, of course, encourage the Libyan stakeholders to establish broad-based, inclusive government, which, once established, would occupy pursue its efforts. We, of course, our interest is to promote stability and promote democracy in Libya, and we look forward to working with all stakeholders to help them achieve those goals.
One, there have been concerns by some critics who say that the AU was sidelined when a major decision by the international community, including NATO, were being taken to isolate and perhaps ensure that Gaddafi loses power. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
From the very beginning of the crisis, we, of course, clearly condemn the violence directed at the civilian population. We call for respect for human rights. We set the need to ensure that the aspirations of the Libyan people for democracy, respect for human rights, good governance were upheld. And it was on that basis that the AU established that committee to follow up on the roadmap that was agreed upon on the 10th of March.
One, there were issues raised that the African Union was not effective in addressing the challenges of Libya because of personal relationship and divisions within the African Union among the heads of state and government. Do you think that is right?
Well, I would say that we made very sustained efforts and we made them based on some fundamental principles. The first one being, of course, the need to ensure that the legitimate aspirations of the Libyan people are fulfilled. And the other principle related to the need to ensure that those aspirations were fulfilled in a peaceful manner. The reality is, in spite of our efforts, is that unfortunately, and for reasons beyond our control, the attempt by the EU did not yield the expected result. That's a reality. But having said that, one has also to acknowledge that very, very sustained efforts were made to find a political solution, because we believe that finding a political solution is the best way of ensuring the long-term stability of Libya.
Elgasim Wand is spokesman for the African Union. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Tomorrow, Thursday, marks 42 years since Libya's Muammar Gaddafi seized power in a coup d'etat. It is an anniversary that, until now, was observed with great fanfare. VOC Elizabeth Arrett attended the lavish 40th anniversary celebrations 2 years ago and is now back in Tripoli for what would have been Mr. Gaddafi's big day.
When Muammar Gaddafi celebrated 40 years in power 2 years ago, he put his picture everywhere. Images of him as a brash young army officer, the self-styled philosopher, the king of all African kings. Today, those posters are still here, only they're on the street, stepped and stomped on by the people he once led. Back in 2009, there were fireworks. Now, tracer bullets light the sky of a Tripolian blackout. Overlooking the harbor is Martyrs Square. Back then, it was Green Square and headquarters for Mr. Gaddafi's massive party for himself. Now bullet casings litter the ground and an effigy of the former leader swings from a scaffold above. One of the biggest changes is that people like Mohamed Toumi are able to speak out. The Tripoli resident excuses himself for the language he uses, but says the past 42 years were crap. The eternal revolutionary, as Mr. Gaddafi was known, had become an emperor with no clothes, no match for a new generation seeking change, and a world which, for the most part, wanted to see him gone. Hints of Mr. Gaddafi's growing isolation could be seen back then. He invited just about everyone, but it was mainly other African leaders, including fellow war crime suspect Omar Bashir of Sudan, who came. During the 40th anniversary celebrations, the Libyan leader did little to hide his autocratic demeanor, slapping his protocol minister in public, as well as his translator. He had state journalists proclaim him, "The man who impresses me," exclamation point included, all the while protected by his phalanx of female bodyguards. But the power he amassed was not enough to protect him from uprisings sweeping the Arab world. Some here say the revolution couldn't have happened without Libya's youth. Salem Nawar, who's in his 60s, believes his generation became accustomed to Gaddafi's oppression.
These youngsters, they've heard, you know, their elder, they have seen their friends being, you know, badly treated, and that, and they came out. Nobody asked them to come out. Nobody asked them they're going to pay them or do this. Okay, a lot of them maybe they think it's fun, and it's, but not, they pay it dearly, you know.
Nearby, two young men linger at the edge of the square, where 2 years ago Africa's leaders came to wish Mr. Gaddafi well.
One wears a T-shirt with a wanted poster for Muammar Gaddafi. His message to the former brother leader is blunt.
I had to, and I think you go to the fire.
It's a message that 2 years ago was unimaginable on the streets of Tripoli. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, in the Libyan capital.
Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Two prominent Ethiopian opposition politicians have been detained, at least one of them on terrorism-related charges. But as VOA's Peter Harline reports from Addis Ababa, opposition leaders are questioning the charges, saying the detentions appear politically motivated.
Government spokesman Shimelis Kemal says senior opposition figure Bekele Gerba was detained Saturday, charged with having ties to the newly outlawed Oromo Liberation Front, or OLF, which is fighting for independence for Oromos, Ethiopia's largest ethnic group.
Bekele Gerba was arrested, detained by the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force in his alleged connection in relation with his involvement with a recently proscribed terrorist organization, OLF.
Bekele, an English teacher at Addis Ababa University, is a member of the executive committee of Ethiopia's main opposition coalition, MEDREC, and deputy chairman of the Oromo Federal Democratic Movement. MEDREC leaders say another prominent Oromo opposition politician, Olbana Lelisa, of the Oromo People's Congress, was also detained. It was not immediately clear whether Olbana was also charged with terrorism. Moga Frisa, who currently serves as chairman of both MEDREC and OFDM, says both men were involved in external communications for their parties. In that capacity, they had been disseminating data about drought and malnutrition in remote regions of southern Ethiopia, data that sometimes contradicts government information. Moga said Bekele in particular had told of the arrests of people who had supplied information for a recent BBC News report. That report alleged Ethiopia has used billions of dollars in development aid as a tool for political repression.
He was talking about a famine in Ethiopia. So they were talking to people and the people were giving them information to these people. We hear also that some of these people who gave information to the BBC have been imprisoned in South. So this we suspect probably this is the cause.
Ethiopia's government strongly denied the BBC report, calling it irresponsible. A statement posted on the Foreign Ministry website noted that opposition parties and the group Human Rights Watch had made the allegations previously, and they had been found to be groundless. The statement argues that allegations of aid misuse are aimed at persuading donors to cut off assistance at a time when millions of people are suffering from one of the worst droughts in decades. Veteran opposition leader Bayene Petros was among those quoted in the BBC report. In a telephone interview Tuesday, he said he stands by allegations of aid abuse. Bayene called the arrests of Bekele and Olbana part of a witch hunt that will have a chilling effect on anyone who might provide embarrassing information about the government to the press. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The National Elections Commission of Liberia will today, Wednesday, release the final tally of the August 23rd constitutional referendum. There are indications that three out of the four propositions may not get the two-thirds majority needed to pass. And with Liberia set to hold presidential elections in October, the question becomes, what's next? Jerome Verdier is the former chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He tells me that assuming the key propositions fail to pass, the logical thing for Liberia to do is to extend the October elections timetable, reconstitute the current elections commission, and call a stakeholders conference to address all the likely transitional issues.
Let's assume, as you have put it, that, for example, the first proposition requiring the reduction of the 10-year residency clause would be rejected. It simply means that the sitting president and several other candidates will be constitutionally barred from taking part in these elections. The results create a conflict situation of its own because it's possible that the president will fight using whatever means possible, the courts or any other means to ensure that she participates in these elections.
Let me ask you then, Counselor, as you said, it's possible the President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, will fight in case Proposition 1 does not pass. The president and other candidates might argue that they were forced to leave Liberia during the Civil War, and therefore they should not be penalized because of the referendum failing.
That's a choice of action the government chose, a wrong choice of action by going to the referendum. And I agree with you, those are valid exceptions, especially those who left the country not at their own volition. They were in exile, not self-imposed exile, but because conditions weren't ripe at home. Those are exceptions to residency requirement. You know, or that case could have been taken at the time to the Supreme Court for proper interpretation, and that would have been the best way rather than taking the entire country down the path of referendum. Now that the people of Liberia would have spoken, it seems very odd that an ambitious president will seek an alternative, meaning that, and the issues that come about is that she doesn't respect the will of the people. There were a lot of Liberians, including stakeholders in the process, who said this referendum wasn't necessary. Now the people of Liberia have spoken, then you submit the opinion of the people of Liberia to a five-man judicial branch, which would be undemocratic, which would be a gross disregard for the opinion, the freedom of the Liberian people. And if the president attempts to do that, it will clearly show that the court is being used to achieve a political aim. The next thing we think about what happens during the general elections itself.
Councillor Verdier, there are some people who are suggesting, or there's a talk about, maybe they can form an interim government. What do you make of that, if that is true now?
Liberia has been placed at a crossroads once more. And this is the kind of scenario we try to avoid by advising the government to proceed cautiously. What we need to do is an extension of the electoral timetable, a reconstitution of the Elections Commission, and a stakeholders conference to address all of these seemingly transitional issues. Because there's no Elections Commission can conduct elections between now and within the 42-day period.
Jerome Verdier is the former chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Liberia. He spoke with me from New York. Several international banks and financial institutions are accused by human rights groups of profiting from the sale of Zimbabwean blood diamonds. Peter Thornycroft reports for VOA that, according to Partnership Africa Canada, Zimbabwe continues to sell diamonds which have not been cleared for sale by international regulators.
Partnership Africa Canada has identified three Zimbabwean banks which it says are involved in processing revenue from sales of illegal rough stones excavated from the Marangi diamond fields in eastern Zimbabwe. Research Director Alan Martin said in Johannesburg Tuesday that the three Zimbabwean banks have international shareholders, including Britain's Barclays Bank and two South African financial companies, Standard Bank and Old Mutual. He said the Zimbabwe banks, the Commercial Bank of Zimbabwe, Bank ABC, and Premier Banking Group are recommended to buyers of the diamonds by the government's Minerals Marketing Corporation. The Minerals Marketing Corporation processes sales of all minerals from Zimbabwe, including diamonds, and is one of several Zimbabwean corporations subject to EU and US sanctions. Martin said these international banks are exposing themselves to reputational harm by being invested in Zimbabwean banks, which he said are trafficking dirty diamonds. He asked these international banks to immediately audit investments in the three Zimbabwean banks to ensure they have not breached commitments to ethical and socially responsible banking.
We asked them to commit to using their shareholder influence to stop illicit diamond-related transactions. And finally, should the Zimbabwean banks refuse their request for better financial governance, we ask they disinvest themselves from these banks.
He said there are six companies now mining small fenced-off sections of land within the huge Marangi communal area in eastern Zimbabwe. The largest of these companies, he said, is Mbada Mining, which has produced most of the controversial stones in the last 2 years. Mbada Mining's chief executive in Zimbabwe is Robert Mtlanga, who secured financing for the company to begin mining operations in Marangi from David Castle, a well-known South African businessman. Peter Thornycroft for VOA News, Johannesburg.
25 minutes past the hour time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoman reporting this morning from Habaroni, Botswana. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Kenyan world 800-meter record holder David Lekuta Rudisha won the gold medal in the two-lap event in 1 minute and 43.91 seconds at the World Athletics Championships in Daegu, South Korea on Tuesday. World indoor champion Abubakar Hamisi Kaki gave Sudan their first medal of the championships when he finished runner-up. Earlier on, little-known Tunisian Habiba Gribi achieved a milestone in her career when she clinched a silver medal in the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase in a new Tunisian national record of 9 minutes and 11.97 seconds. Pre-race favorite Milka Chemos Chewa of Kenya finished third. In the women's heptathlon, Ghanaian Africa champion Margaret Simpson was 14th with 6,183 points. Kenya remained second on the medal table with 3 gold, 2 silver, and 3 bronze medals. Ethiopia is 7th, followed immediately by Botswana. Sudan and Tunisia share 17th spot out of 28 countries that have won medals at the championship so far. Meanwhile, South Africa's Cornel Fredericks and Louis van Zyl qualified for the men's 400-meter hurdles finals. Ethiopian world indoor champion Kalikidan Gezagne, Kenyan newcomer Helen Onsando Obiri, and Moroccan Bissam Lahoudi are through to the women's 1500-meter finals. On the infield, Algeria's former Africa record holder Baya Raouli progressed to the women's triple jump finals. Staying in Daegu, a large field of Africans progressed to the men's 1500-meter semifinals. They are from Morocco, Mohamed Moustawi, Amin Lalou, and Abdelati Igida, Ethiopian Mekonnen Gebremedin, and world indoor champion Deresa Mekonnen. The Kenyans are Silas Kiplagat, Olympic champion Ashbel Kiprop, and Daniel Kipchirchir Komen, along with Algerians Tariq Bukensa and Taufik Makhoufi. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Meseret Tefah, Sentayehu Ejigu, and Genzebe Dibaba advanced to the women's 5,000-meter final. They are joined by Tanzania's Zakia Mrisho, along with the Kenyan quartet of world 10,000-meter champion Vivian Cheruiyot, Lynette Masai, Mercy Cherono, and Viola Jebiwot Kibet. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Habaroni, Botswana. Back to you, James, in our Washington studio.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, August 31st, comes from Umiakuka Morris of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, may I use this forum to remind those who are perpetrating such heinous crimes, such as kidnapping, terrorism, armed robbery, ethnic conflicts, etc., in Nigeria, to know that they are not only harming and killing innocent people, but also they are hurting their own economic well-being. We thank you, Umiakuka Morris of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Nigeria, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Libya's provisional authorities have announced a 4-day deadline for forces loyal to Muammar Gaddafi in his hometown of Sirte to surrender. That's it for this midweek, August 31st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nico Lindsay and reporter Peter Clotty, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very lovely Wednesday.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA,